Well, how are you all this morning? It's very nice to have you with us. It's Tuesday, the 24th of May, and we have a little rainy here. I assume it's probably damp where you are as well. But we have sunshine in our hearts, don't we? And we're here to move on and talk about topics in the news and find out what's going on in the world. Let me introduce our panel to you. A little under the weather, so from an undisclosed location, we go to Dr. Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir.
Okay, well, we'll admit it. I'm in Great Barrington, and I have a little laryngitis. And for an opera singer or a radio person, not good.
No, not good. Well, we're glad you're with us, and we're glad you can croaking it out, as
sing
it
a little.
Were.
So,
that's right.
There's nothing
solo,
like treating laryngitis. Nothing like treating laryngitis by not coming to work and then talking on the radio from home. did you talk to Dr. Vinny Bumbatz about this?
Yeah, I know him well. Yeah, he said go ahead and never listen to Ira. Yeah.
Well, you already been started that.
Speaking of Ira, Ira Fussfeld is with us. He is the Daily Freeman publisher emeritus, and it's always a treat to have him on the program. Thank you very much.
Rare Tuesday visit. Glad to be here.
Thank you for making it up the throughway. Very nice. And, our good friend Mike Spain is here. He is the associate editor of the Times Union newspaper and joins us each and every Tuesday and many other times other than that. And we thank him for being here, as always. Good morning, sir.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
All right, let's move on with some stuff and find out what's happening in the world. I sent a bunch of stories last night, and I normally don't send quite as many as I did last night, but I just thought there was a lot going on, and I figured we could hit a lot of topics and try to get to as many as possible this morning. So we begin with the action in Baltimore, where the officer involved in the Freddie Gray death was acquitted. And the all counts, we should note, the Baltimore officer was acquitted on all charges. Edward Nero. A judge found that Nero was not guilty of all criminal charges in the case of Freddie Gray, whose death last year in police custody sparked riots and widespread anger in the city. The acquittal by Judge Barry Williams, announced Monday in a packed courtroom, is the first verdict reached in the Gray case. Nero is the second officer to face trial on charges related to Gray's arrest and death. The first officer's trial ended in a hung jury. The 30-year-old Nero hugged his lawyers and wiped away tears after Williams read his decision, which culminated the six-day trial. What do you make of this? Mike, let's begin with
well,
you.
Well, it was interesting that he opted for a non-jury trial, and the judge made the sole decision. And you would think that a jury ordinarily would be sympathetic to a police officer. I think they usually are. But he rolled the dice and let the judge make the decision based on, based on the evidence in the case. You know, the state had argued that Nero was guilty of reckless endangerment because he failed to seatbelt Freddie Gray, when he put him in the police van. There had been a directive just a week earlier to all police officers to make sure that prisoners are belted when they're put into these vans, and he didn't comply with that. Some question about whether it had even taken place yet and whether failing to do that amounts to a crime. And I guess the judge felt that it wasn't necessarily his responsibility. It might have been another officer's to sign off on that who was driving the van, because he wasn't in the van. He was there on patrol on a bike, I guess, when Gray was apprehended for some questionable circumstances, where he was running through a neighborhood apparently fleeing, and they assumed he was committing a crime. And for that reason, the prosecution says he was wrongfully arrested, and that amounted to assault. So the whole argument that the prosecutors made fell short.
I gather that there
seems to me.
Go ahead,
sorry.
Go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, it seems to me there are two issues here. One is a political issue. The other is a legal issue. If, in fact, the judge, who happens to be African-American, was doing it properly, he was examining the legal issue. There are those in the community who really felt it should be done politically to satisfy a huge constituency who say Black Lives Matter. And so so it seems to me that's the balance.
Well, you know, there are a number of other police officers who are yet to come up for trial. And my understanding from watching the coverage yesterday was the officer who might be most at risk, if that's the way to put it, is the driver of the van. There didn't seem to be much surprise, nor were there many protests about this verdict yesterday. The lawyer for the Freddie Gray family had nothing but high words for the judge. And so, you know, this thing's just going to roll on. The family, I believe, has already won a rather large civil judgment. So obviously something happened to this guy, and someone in the city of Baltimore was responsible, or there wouldn't have been a settlement. So the pointing to the driver, that may be the case to really watch to see whether or not fairness is meted out here.
2 points of clarification, one on what Ira just said regarding the protests. There were little or no protest following the verdict. There were a couple of people in the courtroom steps and not really much else. Certainly a far cry from the situation that broke out immediately following the incident. Also, we should note it is not immediately clear what, if any, effect Monday's verdict could have on cases against the other officers, or if the remaining defendants would also choose to have their cases decided by a judge rather than a jury. The officers who still face trial, their lawyers and the prosecution are under gag orders and are not permitted to discuss those cases. So we'll see what happens in the down the road.
We've had a letter from Brian, our friend Brian, who writes frequently, says, jury, ordinarily yes, but in certain locales it's more prudent to change venue or to go with a bench trial when the evidence is clear and the judge is objective. And then the next sentence I don't quite understand. Maybe you guys could interpret it for me. Alan is hitting on hit as one type. It must be...
Spell check?
Autocorrect.
Yeah, autocorrect, and I don't know what that means.
Auto make wrong.
The other thing that struck me watching cable news yesterday, I had CNN on, but then I flipped, and I think MSNBC did the same, is that right after the verdict, they had helicopters above the courthouse, and they were sort of looking down. I don't know whether they were rooting for, but they were waiting for the what they
drooling,
might have,
perhaps.
Yeah, waiting to see whether this was going to drive people out on the streets to protest or worse. And again, it's a chicken and an egg thing. You know, if the protesters had come out, would it have been because the helicopters were there and they knew they could get on TV, or you know, was it responsible of them to have the helicopters up covering something that may, as it turned out, did not happen.
Meanwhile, across
well, you got,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, both Ira and Mike, of course, are press experts, and since we have discussed the idea that we've seen cable reporters out on the street saying, "No, I'm standing here, but nothing's happening yet," it's almost as if it's invitational.
Oh, it clearly, when there is a gaggle of reporters and cameras, it will bring people out and. People will gather, and it can become a catalyst to a small incident, a protest, and other things. No question.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the Beltway, just across the city limits of Baltimore in Washington, D.C., the Supreme Court ruled Monday in favor of a black Georgia death row inmate who claimed that prosecutors kept African Americans off the jury that convicted him of murdering an elderly white woman. The court ruled 7-1 that Georgia prosecutors had violated the Constitution, improperly considering race when selecting a jury to judge Timothy Tyrone Foster. And this was, I found this to be a fascinating case. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the majority. Clarence Thomas was the lone African-American on the court. He dissented, saying that the evidence the prosecutors acted improperly was not strong enough to overturn Foster's conviction. The decision did not expand the law, but it laid bare a jury selection process that usually is opaque. It came about because Foster's lawyers, nearly 2 decades after the teenager's conviction in 1987, gained access to prosecutors' notes under Georgia's open records law.
Yeah, and in those notes, the prosecutors identified any prospective juror who was African American with a B, and that indicated that they were steering clear of having blacks on the jury, which could tilt the outcome of the case. And the court
found
that.
Quite a code they had going there, huh?
Except for Clarence Thomas, the judges all agreed that that was that disqualified this thing.
It's my understanding Clarence Thomas's primary objection had less to do with the merits of the case, but that he just didn't think that this was a case that should have been brought before the Supreme Court.
Right, and it wasn't worthy.
So it was
of
a technical.
The court.
Yeah. I'm going to say something that I'm inviting the lawyers listening to tell me where I'm wrong, because I may well be. I couldn't possibly argue with essentially a unanimous verdict in this Supreme Court. If they all, except for Thomas, think that if they're all on the same side, it must have been the right way to go. But here's my point. So they have isolated the fact that you can't just eliminate people because they are black. What about all the other races and ethnicities and religions? It's my understanding in court is that when you're going through the jury selection process, you're trying to select jurors that are going to be favorable to your point of view.
Right. You pick them by age, by gender, by the way they look.
So the court has now made this exclusion for blacks, but what happens if they exclude all Muslims or all Jews or all white people,
or men or women?
Yeah. So I don't know how you can isolate this one case. Although, by a near unanimous verdict, we have to presume that legally they made the right decision.
Well, you got to think of when it was. It was two decades ago, and Georgia, it was a very different place, and it was not uncommon for, I think, the institution to be perhaps a little more biased in the way that it approaches the criminal justice system. And I think it's changed, but it's hard to argue that it's without that.
Alan?
Well, the question is, because of our civil rights struggles in this country, have blacks become a different class in terms of their protections? And I think the courts have been pretty good about this in the past, saying you can't do it. I think when it begins to emerge that the same thing happened, people were preemptorily getting rid of Muslims, I think you're going to probably end up with the same result.
But the ruling that the Supreme Court made was very narrowly focused on this case. It seems to me that a case can be made for all of these kinds of exclusions as a blanket rule for the court, for courts in general.
I think you're right that that is exactly what can happen. And it hasn't yet, but I think what's happening now is it'll be case by case until it becomes clear you need something bigger.
So meanwhile, when we're talking about race, we go to former President Jimmy Carter, 91 years old, who has recently beat cancer, who now has decided in this chapter of his life to take on the issue of racism. In an interview on Monday, President Carter spoke of a resurgence of open racism, saying, "I don't feel good except for one thing. I think the country has been reawakened the last two or three years to the fact that we haven't resolved the race issue adequately." He said that Republican animosity toward President Obama had a heavy racial overtone, and that Donald Trump's surprisingly successful campaign for president had tapped a waiting reservoir there of inherent racism. He has called on a summit meeting to take place in Atlanta to bring together white, black, Hispanic, and Asian Baptists to work on issues of race and social inequality. And this is something that he began back in 2007, but he wants to expand it to enlist congregations across the country to unite across racial lines.
It's as we sit here in the year, what is it, 2016, 8 years of Obama presidency, and 8 years ago when he was elected, how many of us said this is not only a great thing for this country that we finally elected a black man, but that we have cleared a threshold that's only going to improve relations in this country.
A post-racial society.
Yeah, and look where we are now. It in many ways worse than before he came into office. In my view, not of any fault of his. And the rhetoric through these 8 years, largely from the far right wing, has been a steady drumbeat for all these 8 years, and where we are, where we are now.
Well, two things. One, it is for good reason that Jimmy Carter is called the best ex-president this country has ever had, and he is, because he's the conscience. He's the conscience of the country, I'm not sure. I'm thinking about what you said. It's heavy stuff. But were blacks being killed and murdered before the Obama presidency? Or is what's happening now is a consciousness about changing things that comes perhaps because the president is black? I don't know, but to me, it's a great improvement, and it may well be that we're finally paying attention to some things we should have been paying attention to all along.
You're saying it's a great improvement during the Obama years?
I think it's possible that we are now discussing subjects that were not discussable before. And when you have a Black Lives Matter concept, it is in fact correct that Black Lives Matter and that we should be discussing that in a way that we haven't before. So maybe, just maybe, we've moved ahead.
I do want to note as we go to the break here that President Carter also said that Donald Trump had violated basic human rights when he referred to Mexican immigrants as criminals and called for a ban on Muslims, saying when you single out any particular group of people for secondary citizenship status, that's a violation of basic human rights. Jimmy Carter, of course, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002. We're going to take a break. We'll be back.
Really quickly.
Well, I got to go to the news.
Go.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan, we were just going into a break, and you were ready to read us a letter, so please read away.
Well, you know, if I could remember which letter I wanted to read,
it's been a long break.
Well, there are others.
However, Erica said, a jury composition. My understanding is that the jury is supposed to be something of a representative sample of the community, the population this crime occurred. So in the case of Georgia, it certainly should include African-American people. And then there was another one like that who said almost the same thing, and that it had been long established as a matter of law that here it is. The recent decision applied law but did not establish it. Batson versus Kentucky was decided a few years before this case was tried, so that the principle was set. It reasonably should extend to all minorities, but in this case shows penetrating the selection process is difficult, and prosecutors are never held to account for lying. Okay. Well, the point really is they should have known.
Mike, you'd remember this. Joe, you'd remember. In New York State, maybe elsewhere, there was a time that journalists were routinely excluded from juries. And it's my memory that when Chief Judge Kaye, the late Judge Kaye, was one of her primary missions was to make the jury system more inclusive. And so now you have people who do get taken onto juries who would routinely have been excluded in the past.
Including judges. She lifted the ban on having members of the bench serve on juries. And it was awkward in the Bronx when a state Supreme Court judge was sitting on the jury, because everybody would kind of look to the judge and in the deliberation and expect an explanation, and it could create a problem. But as far as journalists go, as long as you don't have intimate knowledge and you covered the case and you interviewed people at the scene of the crime or wrote a lot about it, why should you be exempt? But it was automatic. You were exempt. It was like you didn't have to worry about it.
Because I was put on a jury, and they asked that question. Do you know about this case? Yes. Have you reported on this case? Well, I haven't reported. I have been an anchor telling the story, but I was not actually out doing the on-street reporting. And I was chosen.
I was following on Twitter yesterday. There's a high-profile case that's just beginning now in Kingston. And our reporter, Pat Doxey at the Freeman, is tweeting, and she was tweeting during the jury selection, literally each prospective juror. And much of the discussion yesterday was about the coverage in our newspaper and how much they knew about the case, some people thinking that it was unfair and inaccurate. But some of the people were routinely eliminated, even though they had read about the case, because they said they didn't think they could be fair. But there were others who did read about the case who they at least kept them in the jury pool. And I'm not sure that would have happened years ago.
Well, there's no reason that you can't be fair and objective to sit as a juror if you know something about a case. Mm-hmm. I think that that's the whole point. And that is a false exclusion to say I've heard of the case. So the Judge Kaye did strive to get juries to be more balanced and not just be senior citizens who had extra time on their hands, you know, which is so often the case.
So how come they can't? Yeah. So, Mike, so how come I've been called again and again and again for jury duty, and I never make it past the front bench?
It's the look in your eye, Alan. They say, uh-oh, we don't want any part of this guy.
I think someone used...
We don't want him.
The Freedom of Information
we
Act
don't want him.
To get the notes of those prosecutors in Western Massachusetts, and it has
hey,
A next to your name.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, Alan.
Well, many years ago, I was called...
Well, A may not say
I didn't
Alan.
Say anything. I said Alan.
Yeah, I can't top that. Go ahead.
Who knows? I always tell the story just because I love it. But that jury, by the way, that I was chosen, this is many years ago, that I sat on. Do you know the case? Yes. Do you know the lawyers? Yes. You know the yes. And then so I was chosen, and the foreman of the jury was my mother-in-law.
At what level? Was it a county case?
Yes.
Well, you know, Joe, there's not a lot of prospective jurors in your county.
I realize
there's
that.
Only about 77 people I in just, the pool. You know?
I just think, you know, they're like, oh, well, don't talk to her about the case. It's like, she's my mother-in-law. You know, obviously, we're not going to talk anyway. Okay, let's which isn't true, of course.
Are you under oath?
Trump's tax returns. Let's go back to this issue and talk about this, because it seems as though this is an issue that perhaps Donald Trump, well, I'm sure that Donald Trump would like to see go away, but it is not going away. And there are many people. So now the latest poll of both independents and I believe Republicans, the story is currently loading on my device here, is that 60% say that they want to see the returns and feel that it is important, and that they would hope before the election. Obviously, Hillary Clinton has seized on this and has made this a rallying cry. So I ask two questions. One is, why do you think the numbers are so high? And Alan, I'll ask you this first, and then the second part of that question is, either way, it doesn't. You would assume that something, if there was nothing to be worried about or to hide, they would have been released by now.
One would assume that, but of course, what I'm interested in is Trump keeps making major gains in the polls, right? So that right now it's being described by several organizations as 50-50 between him and her. So. Does this opinion that he ought to release the tax returns rise to the point where people say, as a result of his not doing it, I'm not going to vote for him? Well, apparently Hillary Clinton thinks that may be, and that she ought to jump on this and do it. Nevertheless, we Americans are gossipy and interested, and we make these shows into something that they shouldn't be. And we like Kim Kardashian and her gown releasing itself, and we read all of this stuff. So I'm not so sure how important the tax returns are, just that we want to see them.
Well, it is curiosity, but it could also reveal some details that contradict things that he has said publicly. He has made comments that he tries to pay the lowest amount of taxes possible. If people learned that he wasn't paying any taxes, remember that was revealed about Richard Nixon one year when he had donated his presidential papers to some library and took a tax break on it and basically paid no taxes. That really hurt him in the public eyes. And the other thing is it might show that he's not worth the billions that he says he is. And that would be embarrassing and also portray him as being dishonest.
And heaven forbid we would think he's dishonest.
Well, no, as long as he doesn't release them, people can speculate about how much he doesn't give to charity or what other liabilities are on there and why is he being audited, et cetera, et cetera. And it could be a really, really sharp and shrewd technique to finally release them and have nothing really that big in there. And I wouldn't put it past him.
Well, you know, the current polls, to the extent that they make any sense this many months away from the election, the current polls show at the very least a dead heat between these two. Now, I'm still of the belief that when the Democrats finally emerge and Bernie's people start going over to Hillary, that the balance will shift. And I still believe that Trump is never going to make inroads with African Americans or with Latinos or with women.
Or with women.
That his number is what it is. So I don't think I think Alan's point was what difference does it make or Trump has said, if I could go out and shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, my numbers wouldn't change. I don't think that the non-release of his taxes is hurting him in his base. The people who are going to vote for Trump have already made the decision because he's already done and said so many things that ordinarily candidates would turn off their followers. But if it is in fact a narrow election based on the current polls, if only a relative handful of people say, why isn't he releasing his tax returns? I don't think I can vote for him because I don't know what he's hiding. That's going to be important to the election.
It would be the first time in 40 years that a presidential candidate in a major party has not released their tax returns. And it just leaves speculation, as you're saying, that what is he trying to hide? And that could hurt him among independents who've yet to make their mind up.
Ira, I just wanted to ask you a very brief question. Were you one of the 10,000 pundits who said that Trump could never be the Republican nominee?
Yes, I was. I also was one of those who said Bernie could never be the nominee. But I've changed, obviously, as time has gone along.
My point, and I'm being facetious, of course, but my point really is a lot of people have underestimated this guy.
No doubt.
Fearfully so.
No doubt. But, we still need to not be carried away by the closeness of the race now, particularly because Hillary is not only getting beaten up by him, but by Bernie. And if, in fact, Hillary succeeds in drawing most of, if not all, of Bernie's supporters, that's a large swath of voters that are going to come over to her side, and it's going to widen the gap.
Joe, if I may, our Barbara Smith checked in on the last discussion. I wanted to read it. Yes. A great deal of history is being overlooked in this morning's discussion. The exclusion of black people from juries in the U.S. is centuries, not decades old. As jubilant as African Americans were when President Obama was elected, I know of none who thought institutionalized racism would magically diminish or disappear as a result. A key factor in the Black Lives Matter movement's viability is video cameras, not who is president. And by the way, Barbara and everybody else, that point about the video cameras has been made in several notes to us. That's really what's changed.
It changed for the better.
Well, it's been an uncomfortable revelation to people, but it has documented how biased police can be.
But the underlying point that Jimmy Carter is making is that racism has gotten worse, and I suspect that many black people and many white people would agree with that. If you do agree with it, I would also suggest that that is surprising given the fact that the country has elected and then reelected a black president, because we presumed that that was going to be the final threshold in all but eliminating racism, and that clearly has not happened.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back and continue and wrap up the last part of our program. We welcome your letters, as always. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We will be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from SPAC, celebrating their 50th anniversary with modern dance featuring Doug Verone and dancers June 17th, Twyla Tharp Dance Company June 30th, and Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater July 8th and 9th. SPAC.org for tickets. Hotchkiss Summer Portals, Lakeville, Connecticut, a hands-on program for adults with sustainable farming and farm-to-table cooking with local chefs. July 7th through 10th, hotchkiss.org/summer to register. And Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham providing career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume, and cover letter writing. CareersInTransitionLLC.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very, very nice to have you with us. Oh, hey, Alan, we got some good news here. The lockbox currently.
Great.
You ready? The lockbox currently is at $182,284. That's very nice. Well, very nice.
Well, we have it is nice. It's progressive. We're making it. But really, in the end, we need $210,000 or something.
To get where
we were last time. Yeah, we need to make it. And it just means that the motivation here is all self-imposed. We go to the lockbox because we believe in the station, because we use the station, because we need it. And for those people who say you spend too much time raising money during the fund drive, I love the fund drive, by the way, but for those people who say, and then when I walk up to them, we all know what they say. I say, did you put anything in the lockbox? That's it. Get it?
I got it. And you can get in on this by simply going to WAMC.org. And not only that, but we have the vote package, which is vote for WAMC. Yep. It is a beautiful T-shirt. It's gorgeous. It's black. And then it has a stark white logo on the
and a check.
A small logo on the front of the shirt. And then on the back, a larger logo with a check. Vote
Huge.
For WAMC. It looks great. They can see it coming down Fifth Avenue. And then they have it in the convenient mug form as well as the T-shirt. $100 pledge gets you that, or you can put in whatever you can put in to the lockbox. $5,
anything at all.
$25, $5,000, whatever you can put in. WAMC.org. Again, we're at $182,284. So thank you to all who have done something, and now it's obviously your turn. Okay,
that's terrific.
Let's go back to the topics at hand and find out what else we would like to
Joe.
Yes.
Joe, if I may, Al wrote us a very interesting letter. Not that we can discuss it now, but I think we ought to talk about it as a potential for a whole show, which is, he says, Carter, his non-support of the Shah of Iran made the bad Arab situation in the Arab world worse. Carter naively lit the fire. Shah was not a good guy, but he kept violent radicals in line. What I take away from that letter, which I don't agree with most of, is that it takes a different kind of person to be a president than to be an ex-president. And in other words, you can have conscience as an ex-president that you might not have if you have to deal with some of the very difficult ethical decisions around the world.
Absolutely. I want to go back to one other thing, and Mike, I meant to do this earlier, and that was the story. There was actually somewhat of a connection to the Freddie Gray story in Troy, which has been going on, and I meant at the time to go to it, but I instead moved on to the other stories we had.
Yeah, I mean, it's connected in that it involves a police officer who was involved with a motorist, and the motorist was African-American. there was a confrontation and the motorist was shot and killed by the police officer. This is in the city of Troy, and it happened back on April 17th. And now the family of this man, who lives in Watervliet across the river from Troy, has filed a wrongful death suit against the city of Troy, Rensselaer County's District Attorney Joel Abel Love, and some others, the police chief and the actual officer, Sergeant Randall French, who back on the 17th of April fired 8 shots through a windshield at 37-year-old Edson Theveden as his vehicle allegedly pinned French's legs against a police cruiser following a brief pursuit after a traffic stop. They suspected him of DWI. When he was stopped, he took off in his car, and police pursued him onto the bridge that connects Albany County and Troy. And on that bridge is where this confrontation happened. It's an interesting case. Brendan Lyons, our investigative editor, reporter and editor, has been covering this closely. Over the weekend, Brendan reported that very unusual case because the district attorney, within 5 days of this shooting, brought the case to a grand jury, which found there was not evidence for an indictment against the police officer. At the same time, the state attorney general, Eric Schneiderman, was invoking a executive order from last year issued by Governor Cuomo that would give the attorney general jurisdiction in cases like this where an unarmed civilian dies from police action. The question is, of course, whether the car was a weapon in this case, and that's certainly what the police have argued. But nonetheless, the attorney general had invoked his authority, and while he had done that, the DA brought the case to a grand jury and granted immunity to the officer, which means that even if the attorney general's investigation shows there was wrongdoing, and it has not. But if the investigation does conclude that, apparently the officer will be exempt from any kind of prosecution because he was granted immunity when he testified before the grand jury. And the whole thing is kind of murky. The district attorney's been under a lot of criticism. The New York Times has written editorials about his actions and, you know, some speculation that he did an end run. Certainly the attorney general has speculated that, you know, to ram this case through and conclude it without proper vetting of other witnesses. There were a couple of other witnesses that we spoke to that were not brought before the grand jury. So there's a lot of questions. Now the family of this gentleman, the wife and the children, are filing notice of claim that they're saying it's a wrongful death.
This is a story that has been making national headlines. I mean, it is something that is garnering a lot of attention, no doubt because of what's going on in the rest of the country.
Right. It's another case. And really, after the death of Eric Garner in Staten Island a couple of years ago, he was selling Lucy's cigarettes on the street, which was a violation of the law. And the police apprehended him and put him in a head choke or a choke hold.
Yeah.
Ended up, he died of asphyxiation, and there was a grand jury inquest into that, and police were exonerated, essentially, even though it was caught on videotape, and many people felt that they had acted overacted in that. And but there was no charges brought. After that, the Governor Cuomo issued an executive order that would let the Attorney General Schneiderman step in certain cases where there might be questions. There's some belief that a grand jury convened by the local DA is too close to the local police to be objective, and certainly that's been suggested by the actions of Joel Abel of the DA in Rensselaer County.
And that's the other thing that I think so interesting about this case, and maybe makes it a little unique in that the actions of the DA are being examined in a way that you don't usually see. I mean, the subtext of all of this is the DA did wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the attorney general's investigation will also look at the actions of the district attorney, and there may be some outcome from that. But certainly it will hurt him politically, I presume, when he's up for re-election in a couple of years.
But it is one of those
things. You never know.
Yeah. It is one of those things, though, that I have to wonder. just when I read the story, and as much as I is, if you look into it, it definitely seems wrong to me. But I also wonder why it hasn't happened before. Do you know what I mean? like it seems like that would be something that would have been tried before now.
You mean ramming a...
No, it's quite suspicious.
Yeah.
Well, it was very unusual. The death happened on an early Sunday morning. That next day, police...
I mean, is it just that everything was sort of in...
By Friday.
In line to be able to go through so quickly?
Right. By Friday, before they even had toxicology reports back on the autopsy of Mr. Thevenin, they... You know, they brought to a grand jury, and they did not bring witnesses that have told us it appeared that the officer was not in any danger. That was just the car had been rolling, and some suggestion of when the shots were fired, before or after the car rolled into the officer. So that hasn't been determined. And there's a lot of, you know, and apparently there was a video. Somebody captured some of this on their cell phone, and without any of that evidence going to the grand jury found that the officer acted the way he was trained to act to defend himself when threatened, and now the attorney general is moving to nullify that whole action and take over the case. There'll be more on this.
Absolutely.
And as we all know, Jassal Wachler, the chief judge, once said, a ham sandwich. DA could indict a ham sandwich.
Right, the famous line that if a DA wants to get somebody indicted, they can indict a ham sandwich. Just in turn, if a DA can, by choosing who and who does not come before the grand jury and what evidence is presented and what evidence is not presented, can control who is not indicted. That's certainly...
Joe, I don't know if we have 1 second, but we had an interesting letter from Jeff who said, any thoughts on Hillary's declining Fox's invitation to debate Bernie on their network? Thanks, Jeff. Well, I mean, here's Hillary, who is dealing with the idea that Bernie is upsetting her apple cart. And by debating him, it could only be made worse. So I certainly understand where she's coming from.
We'll do some more on that and talk about that tomorrow, because I think there's a lot more to discuss. We are out of time this morning. Alan, I see they're getting you ready for your next go around. So thanks to you. Ira, thank you. We'll see you on Thursday. Michael, see you very soon, I hope. And we'll return with more Roundtable after this short break.